From WUOT News, this is The Method, a series exploring the intersection of science and society. I'm Brandon Hollingsworth. Nearly 90 years ago, the eyes of the nation turned to Tennessee. In the summer of 1925, science and religion went toe-to-toe in a Ray County courtroom. The subject was evolution, and though there was a winner and a loser in the Scopes trial, the debate over how biology should be taught was far from settled. In fact, it's still not settled today. This year, there's talk in Nashville of altering the State Textbook Commission in response to parental complaints. The concerns this time around are aimed mainly at history books, but the struggle facing the panel that evaluates books for classroom use isn't new, and it's not unique to Tennessee. To get some perspective on science education and the political process, I turn to the University of Tennessee's Dr. Ed Caudill.
What we have is a political issue, that we want to decide science via political channels, that the school board will make a decision on what should be taught in the science class or other classes too.
You know, I remember coming home from school as early as, you know, sixth or seventh grade and showing my parents a homework assignment and getting blank stares in return. And then because it had been so long since they'd been in a classroom, and also educational standards had changed. And I think that's almost a rite of passage for most parents. The day your kid comes home with that homework assignment and you just draw a blank, you can't help them. But there are voices in Nashville that are calling for the State Textbook Commission to include more and more parents and laymen and people who are not directly involved in education. But for the state textbook panel, whose job it is to judge the accuracy and the utility of textbooks, that sounds like it may not be very productive to include people who are not educators or not professionals.
It's not productive in terms of the quality of science education. The idea is the same in other areas, like climate change. If I don't believe in it, then it must not be true. Well, the same thing here, that if enough of us vote against it, then evolution isn't true anymore. It's an odd idea, but when you peel back the layers of the controversy, that is precisely what's going on. We stack the vote for one side or the other, and I think you're right. These folks aren't qualified, in many cases, to talk about science.
One of the complaints in certain corners about biology texts in particular is that they should at least give equal weight to evolution or to intelligent design or creationist theories. But one is supported by sort of an ocean of evidence and the other is not. And so the opposing view would be we shouldn't give them equal time because they're not equal. I wonder if you'd help us sort of explore that debate.
It's a bogus argument because you're pleading for equal time when in a science class, when one of the sides has no validity to it whatsoever. Equal time in a science class for science and non-science. That's silly. But that's what's being demanded.
What kind of position does that put educators in?
Oh, they're in the pressure cooker with it then. What happens a lot of times, not just in Tennessee, across the country, you see people, educators, simply dodge the question. They just move around it. Isn't it ironic that in an era when we're pleading for better science and technical education to say, let's just jump over this whole issue that's a guiding principle of biology?
Now, we've seen state boards of education and textbook commissions from Texas to Alabama to Kansas and other states bending to that political pressure that you're talking about, softening the science standards in deference to popular ideologies. How do you see the debate that's currently shaping up in Tennessee playing out?
I don't think that we're going to see some resolution here. I think this is a very durable conflict, mainly because the sides are irreconcilable.
Ed Caudill is a professor of journalism and the author most recently of Intelligently Designed, How Creationists Built the Campaign Against Evolution. Zoological parks have long been a way for humans to encounter animals they wouldn't otherwise see in daily life. WUOT's Chrissy Kuiper reports on the new role that zoos are playing in the survival of those species.
Every day, more habitats are lost and more animals disappear from the wild. As a result, zoological parks worldwide are playing a much more integral role in species survival, not only by housing and maintaining these animals, but by sponsoring breeding programs and sharing the animals among zoological facilities. The Knoxville Zoo is one of these facilities.
Essentially, what an SSP is trying to do is maintain a genetically viable population in zoos so that if and when they ever sort out the issues that are affecting them in their wild habitat, potentially you could put the animals back.
Sarah Glass is curator for one of the Knoxville Zoo's most popular animals, the red pandas. The zoo has 24 official species survival plans underway, including the red pandas, Andean condors, African elephants, snow leopards, and radiated tortoises, just to name a few. So the idea of the SSP is to boost the numbers of an animal so that there's a broad genetic pool. Again, Glass, along with Terry Cannon, the zoo's curator of mammals.
We got our first pandas in 78, which was actually before the red panda SSP formed, which was in 1984.
We started when we became accredited. That's when you really get involved in the program, when you become an accredited zoo. Part of the accreditation process is agreeing to participate in these programs and abide by what they request.
And zoos aren't the only facilities involved in the program. Mike Ogle is the assistant curator of herpetology and oversees the zoo's SSPs for reptiles, including the endangered radiated tortoises. Ogle says there are private keepers that help with the SSPs, whether they are private facilities or individuals who keep turtles in their backyards.
They'll help out by trading out bloodlines with us. We'll vet them just to make sure they're not selling animals illegally or doing something of that nature. And a lot of private keepers are just as good, if not better, than some zoos. In fact, some animals I'd rather send to certain private folks than to some zoos.
Another facet to the species survival plans is that this is now the way that zoos acquire certain types of animals. Sarah Glass says that zoo animals no longer come straight from the wild.
If you want to have a certain species in a zoo, you need to breed it responsibly. There really is no taking out of the wild anymore.
As far as seeing those animals return to the wild, Glass and Cannon both say that's a bit of a pipe dream.
In some cases, those areas just may not exist anymore. But you want to make sure you're putting back a behaviorally competent and genetically accurate animal.
The hope is and that places will protect their natural environment, will protect the habitat of these animals so that there's a population living free and thriving. At least we have this repository of the potential to make a difference and reintroduce them if ever there's a chance.
For many animals, the species survival plans are the last chance. I'm Chrissy Kuiper, WUOT News.
That does it for this edition of The Method. You can listen to all of our past shows online at WUOT.org. Until next time, I'm Brandon Hollingsworth.